from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today, Christian Theological Seminary bookstore manager Nick Buck and CTS librarian Anthony Elia will join us in a discussion about Harper Lee's book, Go Set a Watchman.
I'll learn about the first time ever that auditions are held for the Hastings Piano Competition in the United States, and not just in the U.S., but in Muncie.
And I'll check out this year's German Fest. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. We're starting off today's show with a different type of Art of the Matter segment, a book discussion. Joining Travis DiNicola in the studio are Christian Theological Seminary bookstore manager Nick Buck and CTS librarian Anthony Elia, who have both recently read and reviewed Harper Lee's new book, Go Set a Watchman.
Nick, Anthony, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you guys here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
We're happy to be here.
So this is really interesting. I mean, Nick, you manage the bookstore at CTS. Anthony, you're the librarian there, and obviously, you guys love books like I do, and talk about them a lot. But this seems more even intentional. I mean, when Go Set a Watchman came out, you two chose to go back, reread To Kill a Mockingbird, read Go Set a Watchman, and have talked about it, written a lot, right?
Well, yeah, Nick and I, we both run book groups out of CTS, and we talk about books all the time. And when this came out, we debated it, we read it, we reread Mockingbird, and we were in discussion for a long time. I mean, 2 months on, we're still talking about it. Mm-hmm. So it was really important to us, I think.
Yeah. Nick?
Yeah, I remember when it came out, I initially thought I had to go back and reread the To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm-hmm. You know, having read it in, high school, I think. It had been so long, and all the reviews early on were contrasting the two books, I realized I had to go back and really look at that first novel of hers, or at least the first one that was released, in order to get a good gauge on what she was trying to do.
Sure, sure. And it's kind of become a project, though, with both of you. I mean, in terms of looking at the two and talking about the two, comparing the two. I find it interesting that, I mean, of course, a lot of people were doing this, but also with the two of you coming from the perspective of working with CTS and looking at the religious connotations with the book as well. I mean, that's sort of been a part of your approach too, right?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, as religious folks and people who are products of divinity schools and seminaries and people who work at them, in many ways are people of texts, and that's sort of what we build our lives around. And this is a good opportunity to do some of the same work we might do with the Bible or theological texts, but maybe with some contemporary literature texts.
Sure.
Yeah, and when we read these books, as I said, we discussed them, then each of us wrote reviews, mm-hmm. and then we rewrote the reviews, and the final review that I wrote last week was probably the fourth or fifth draft, and it came after reading other books, which I thought...
You read a lot of biographies about Harper Lee and other criticism, right?
Yes, and there's one major biography of Harper Lee by Charles Shields, which he didn't have any cooperation with Harper Lee, but he did investigate her life. He went to her hometown in Alabama, and I think he interviewed 700 people or something like that. There's another book by Maria Mills where she was a Chicago Tribune journalist, and she spent time, several months, living next door to Harper Lee and mm-hmm. got to live with her and learn more about her. And I got an interesting sense of who the people were in the context of Harper Lee's life, including her sister and her parents and her neighbors. And it's an interesting portrait that comes up and prompts a number of questions about the novels themselves, how they were formed, how they were changed, how they were rewritten, mm-hmm. What motivations there may have been. And so those are sort of the questions that arose and led Nick and I to kind of dig into these the topics that arose.
Let me ask you a pretty basic question here, just to start with. Because before we were going on the air, we were talking about, you guys asked me if I had read Ghost Head of Watchmen, and I haven't. And when it came out, sort of after the initial reviews came out, I'm like, you know, I'm feeling good about my experience of reading To Kill a Mockingbird. I don't feel like I need to go read Ghost Head of Watchmen. But you two chose to do that and made an intentional point of doing so. Was that the right decision for you, Nick?
I think so. I mean, one of the things that the conclusions I came to was, for whatever reason, Harper Lee published To Kill a Mockingbird before she published Ghost Head of Watchmen. I know there's a lot of dispute about whether she actually wanted Ghost Head of Watchmen to be published.
Yeah.
But we thought that we would give the sort of the historical record some credit here and recognize that during her life, she chose to publish To Kill a Mockingbird. And so there's a sense in which to root these back into the same author was to put them in the same context. And I thought that without reading To Kill a Mockingbird first, we would have a problem doing that, partially because the movie...
Mm-hmm.
You know, To Kill a Mockingbird.
It's such right. It's almost impossible to separate the movie from the book. I mean, I was talking to a person today who's, you know, who just actually watched the movie over the weekend, and, you know, I was talking about Gregory Peck, and of course, I mean, that's our image of Atticus.
Right. And I think that's actually kind of unfortunate, and that's one of the reasons why we thought we'd read the book, because the book, and actually this is true for both books, are really about John Louise or Scout Finch, not Atticus. Atticus plays a very, very important role, but he's certainly not the central figure. Whereas if you were to watch the movie, you would think that it was actually just about Atticus.
Well, and this is the debate that Nick and I had was really, well, what is this book about, and what are the titles? What do they indicate? Part of it is, you know, especially through the film, people think it's the trial. It's the trial. There's a big contingent of attorneys in this country that were raised on, you know, Atticus.
And, that's why they became attorneys.
Right, that's why they became attorneys. And the more we thought about it, we thought, reading both of these books, it's not necessarily about the trial, but it becomes that in some ways in Mockingbird. And I think in a lot of high schools that teach us and colleges, they focus on the trial and aspects of the trial. But if you look at the titles, see, there are a number of titles that are floating around. The original title for the book was Atticus. And so we think, well, what does that mean? What was Harper Lee trying to say when she chose that title? And when the editors at Lippincott said, well, maybe that's not a good title. How should we change this? And then, of course, To Kill a Mockingbird has its own meaning. Ghost Head of Watchmen is an interesting title.
Yeah, I've been wondering about that. Because obviously To Kill a Mockingbird, it's you know, I mean, going back to the book, I'm sort of paraphrasing here, but it's, you know, sort of a senseless act of cruelty.
Right, exactly. Now, Ghost Head of Watchmen, interestingly, and Nick and I were just talking about this, this is Harper Lee takes this line from Isaiah 21, and it's actually the King James Version. Now, Harper Lee was a huge fan of English literature and English history. She and her sister were really, her sister Alice is no longer alive, but she was a great fan of England, and Harper Lee still is. So she took this translation from the King James, and it comes out of Isaiah 21. Now, the context of Isaiah 21 is interesting because it's a prophecy of the fall of Babylon. And before this line, go set a watchman, which in more recent translations would be something like go post a lookout, but we can't imagine that as a artful title for this book. But the portions before this in Isaiah 21 are about a person saying things like, my heart falters, fear makes me tremble, the twilight I longed for has become a horror to me. And then later on, after this watchman is waiting to see what's happening, the person they're waiting for comes back and says, Babylon has fallen. All the images of its gods lie shattered on the ground. And so really what that image is there is that all the expectations that you have, at least for Harper Lee, of what the world is, it's been shattered. Your idols have been shattered. Your gods have been shattered. And so nothing has its sacredness anymore.
So Atticus is not the watchman.
Now, that's what's interesting. I think both of these books, especially in contrast, sort of brings out the case that Harper Lee was trying to write, from my view, a coming-to-age tale. You know, that was an honest portrayal of the mid-century South. And I think in both books she has this disillusionment with the people around her. You know, maybe people she had higher expectations for than you could actually pan out. And that's part of that coming-of-age process. But the difference is, in To Kill a Mockingbird, I think it's the townspeople that she becomes disillusioned about because of their sometimes overt, often just covert racism, and in fact classism as well. But then in Ghost at a Watchman, I think it's primarily her father.
It is her father that she becomes disillusioned with in that stage of her coming of age. And you've said in your review, Nick, that Atticus is essentially really a different character in the two books.
Yeah, and this is a point of contention, of course. And it has a lot to do with sort of authorial intent and when they were written and what she was trying to do in the pieces themselves. But it seems to me that Atticus in both stories is a very different character. And it's not just reducible to the fact that from one we see Atticus from the adolescent view of Scout Finch and the other one is an adult. Mm-hmm. I think it's more substantial than that. It seems to me that in To Kill a Mockingbird, and this is what makes Atticus so great, is that he's largely able to transcend his moral context. He's able precisely to be a better person than all of those around him, the townspeople namely, rise above their racism, even if he does fall to it in some places, but largely transcend that context. Whereas I think in Ghost at a Watchman, he's very firmly a product of his context, right? And this is that common ethical quandary. What's the relationship of our sort of moral worldview to our context? And mm-hmm. I think Atticus has a very different relationship in the two books, which to me marks Atticus off as a different character in the two respective works.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. And in fact, I think at one point Nick and I were trying to reconcile these differences.
Mm-hmm.
Early on when I was trying to come up with some reason, I tried to reconcile these two Atticuses, if I may. And I tried to manage it in some way. And in the end, I said to Nick, you know, really, I'm a historian, really. And I said, well, I'm just going to say Harper Lee changed her mind. And she changed it for various reasons and some reasons we might not, you know, ever mm-hmm. know. But the interesting thing is that if you look at her life, at Harper Lee's life, much of the both of these books reflect what was happening to her. And her father, her Harper Lee's father, in many ways reflected the character of Atticus in, mm-hmm. in Watchmen, the character who was not necessarily the good guy that was portrayed in Mockingbird. Now, the interesting turn, maybe paradox, is that A.C. Lee, her father, became more like the good Atticus in Mockingbird later on.
Later on in his life.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in part due to the book. Mm-hmm. So that I think that's a fascinating historical twist.
Yeah. Let me ask you this just about the writing in Watchmen. I've heard many people say that it seems like it wasn't as edited as the writing in Mockingbird. Did you find that in reading that at times like the style or such just wasn't as strong?
Yeah, it felt to me like not necessarily that the two books came from a different pen, but it was hard for me to imagine both stories being very, very close to to Harper Lee's pen. Hmm. Actually, because of the stark difference, I think in Ghost at a Watchman, you have this sort of disjointed narrative of sort of self coming of age, and it's almost postmodern in the sense that it's about internal struggle and how that internal struggle matches or doesn't match the outside world. Whereas I think To Kill a Mockingbird is almost an Andy Griffith-esque sort of idyllic, nostalgic look at the past. And the style is smoother. And I think the moral issues are more clean. It's more childlike in many senses. And
well, Flannery O'Connor said, she said the book, I can't remember the exact quote, it was something like, it's a good book for a child, which is why Harper Lee never liked her.
Sure.
There was this, you know, this tension there. But yeah, I agree with Nick. It's definitely, you know, there are some stylistic mm-hmm. issues, but I think that they were cleaned up, if that's what we want to call it. Watchmen is a more ragged, raw, and in some ways honest book coming from Lee. I think it's really, she's also dealing, I think, with issues in her own life, the death of her mother, the death of her brother, going to to New York City and coming back to her hometown. Whereas Mockingbird, like Nick just said, it's Mayberry-esque. It's got this aspect to it that makes it feel almost too, I don't want to say contrived necessarily, but it's very
it's controlled.
It's controlled. Sense, yeah. I think that's a good way to put it.
Let me ask you this question to wrap it up. So many people whether they're attorneys or just readers of all types, you know, still have this image of Atticus as such a hero to them. And, you know, many people, if they would say, you know, who's the fictional character you admire most, they would say Atticus. And that's why people love To Kill a Mockingbird so much. For that type of reader, I mean, it seems like for both of you that reading both books has actually really made both books, has brought more out of them for both of you, that I think you understand them better, you're seeing more of them, it's become more complex. But for that type of reader who has, like, that sort of idealized image of Atticus, you know, is reading Watchmen going to be a good choice or not? What do you think? Nick?
Yeah, this, I think, has something to do, at least from in my mind, about what Harper Lee was trying to do with the books. And I think what the contrast of the two novels read together can do for us is sort of prevent us from casting ourselves or seeing in ourselves the image of the moral exemplar, right? That one who's able to transcend their context and do the right thing for the right reasons, regardless of what everyone else is doing. And while I think that that's obviously something that's good to set our sights on, the reality is I think Harper Lee was trying to portray the implicit racism and classism in her mm-hmm. society. And the gift of the two books together helps us see how we are in many ways complicit in the same sorts of discrimination, and stops us short from just seeing us in Gregory Peck.
Right. I
agree with that insofar as I think for a certain readership, for instance, I'm not totally convinced that that would necessarily work within the context of high schools where most of these most copies are sold and mm-hmm. students read. I think it would be a much deeper, much richer, a much more nuanced way of reading the books, but I'm not sure that that would be a practical way of doing it. On the other hand, I think what Nick said is spot on, and I think that for book groups and for folks in colleges and universities, definitely reading both of these books is imperative, really.
Excellent. Nick? Anthony, great to have you both on Art of the Matter today, and really appreciate you coming on for this book discussion about Ghost at a Watchman.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot.
Travis DiNicola with Christian Theological Seminary Bookstore Manager Nick Buck and CTS Librarian Anthony Alaya. For more information about the Christian Theological Seminary, visit cts.edu. Again, cts.edu. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
The Hastings International Piano Competition has a high profile among music lovers abroad, but now, thanks to the work of Ball State University Distinguished Professor of Piano, Bob Palmer, preliminary auditions will be held not only in the United States, but here in Indiana. Sharon Gamble invited Bob, as well as Rebecca Braun, who's assistant to the director of the School of Music at Ball State, to tell us how this came about and what effect it will have on the university.
So, Bob, before we talk about the Hastings piano competition and the auditions, I want to know what led you to the piano in the first place?
Oh, what a great question, Sharon. I was 7 years old and one of six children, and my mom just thought we should all play the piano. So all six of us children did. My mom was a pianist, not professionally, but she just enjoyed playing.
Wow.
And apparently when I was 2 or 3 years old, I showed some inclination towards music. I love to listen to the radio mm-hmm. and just music on the radio. Especially, I guess, I loved listening to the Ray Conniff Orchestra and singers. So I showed some proclivity for dancing and singing, and so off we went with piano lessons starting at age 7.
Was your father musical as well?
He was tone deaf.
It's all about balance in a marriage, isn't it?
There we go.
And did any of your siblings end up choosing music for their careers?
My older brother was a fantastic clarinetist, All-State in Minnesota where we grew up, but he ended up following the family business, which is printing. And I do have one sister who is an independent piano teacher. She has about 35 students. She teaches privately in Minnesota.
So strong chromosomes for music
there
in your family.
Go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's one thing to be a pianist. It's another to discover that you have a gift for teaching. How did that happen?
Yeah, I think it actually started with my upbringing, Sharon. My parents were extremely nurturing and loving to all six of us. And all the teachers I studied with throughout my training were also the same way, very, very nurturing. And I just think it's very important as a teacher that you find so much satisfaction in giving rather than receiving.
Mm-hmm. And something tells me the same is true when you're adjudicating piano competition, or any kind of competition,
sure.
But in your case, piano competitions.
Yes.
You've done that a lot.
I have, yeah, both in this country and abroad. The abroad experiences have included judging competitions in Russia and Thailand and England. And in this country, many different states, but one that I've enjoyed maybe the most was right here in Indianapolis judging for APA, American
yeah.
Pianist Association, that fantastic organization that Joel Harrison runs so superbly, and I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of that organization.
Mm-hmm. Do you notice any significant differences when you're traveling abroad, or is it just musicianship, no matter what language you speak when you're away from the keyboard?
It is a universal language, isn't it? There's that shared commonality
mm-hmm.
among musicians. But having said that, I guess I always have a little bit of wanderlust and adventure in me, and so to experience the different cuisines and cultures of different countries is always fascinating to
yeah.
me, and just how different people are.
Mm-hmm. So the Hastings Piano Competition, you personally are the reason they opened up to have auditions in the United States. How did that come about?
Yeah, it's a pretty neat a journey. Last summer, it was July of 14, I was invited to teach in Malaga, Spain for a wonderful summer music festival there. And another faculty member was from England. His name is Frank Vibo, W-I-B-A-U-T, but pronounced Vibo. And Frank is just a fantastic person, pianist, and teacher. And we just hit it off from the very beginning of that festival. One of Frank's bio clips states that he's played Beethoven's Emperor Concerto more than 500 times.
Oh, my goodness.
So I met him. I introduced myself, and I said, Frank, what a great piece of information. Can you play it in any key? I said jokingly, and he replied equally jokingly, no, but it's the only piece I know. And so we just kind of hit it off right from the get-go. And towards the end of that festival, he said, Robert, I have this competition in Hastings, England, that I'm the artistic director for. And it's a wonderful international piano concerto competition, and I'd love for you to be on the jury. And I said, well, I'd love to do that, Frank. So this past spring, in March, I was in Hastings serving on the jury. And on the penultimate day of the competition, he approached me, and he said, Robert, I'm thinking of having live preliminary round auditions for next year's Hastings competition.
Hmm.
And I said, what a great idea, Frank. And I said, well, you have to come to the United States. And he said, well, of course. And I said, well, now, Frank, of course you could go to New York. It's the cultural capital of this country, as
mm-hmm.
everybody knows. But if you're a really talented pianist on the West Coast, that's a 7 or 8 hour flight to get there. Why don't you consider coming to the middle of the United States, like maybe Indiana? Or like Ball State University.
Enlightened well, self.
And he thought, this sounds great. And so it was actually pretty much that easy. And so we're one of four worldwide sites, the other three being Tokyo, Japan, London, England, and Hamburg, Germany.
I think that might be the first time Indianapolis, Indiana has been included in that particular sentence.
Exactly. And in particular, Muncie,
yeah.
Indiana, because that's where the preliminary...
Sorry, I said Indianapolis,
said,
Muncie.
Yeah, but that's where the preliminary site will be this November.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Now, Rebecca, when Bob came back and said, I've committed us to something, what was the response?
We were all very excited. Of course, there were meetings that had to happen to make sure that we could support this. And obviously, we wanted to, but we just needed to get things in order to make it happen.
Sure.
But, you know, what a fantastic opportunity to host this.
So what is the age range of the competitors? Is it?
It's 16 through their 30th year, so up to 31.
So very comparable. A number of our listeners are also, in addition to being familiar with APA, they're familiar with the International Violin Competition, which,
right.
looking at the structure of this, it's very, very similar, mm-hmm. kind of a similar number of people coming for first round and so forth.
Exactly.
How are you finding, what are the rules for people who audition?
Yeah. One of the really nice things about this particular competition, Sharon, is for an international piano competition, the repertoire requirements are not that excessive. For the preliminary round at BSU, it's just 25 to 30 minutes of solo piano music. And the only stipulation, it has to be at least two different styles, thus at least two different composers.
Sure.
Otherwise, it's potluck. You can play anything you want. If you make the next stages in Hastings, you need to have a full concerto from the 19th or 20th century, and then just the first movement of a Mozart and Beethoven concerto.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That gets you through all of the rounds, including the finals.
And how are you, plural, you and the Hastings Piano Competition, getting the word out to get the auditioners involved?
Yes. We've sent out over about 150 letters to all of the top music schools, conservatories, universities in this country, Canada, and Mexico. We have a full-page ad in the American Music Teachers Magazine, which is the monthly journal for MTNA, the mm-hmm. Music Teachers National Association. I've made many phone calls, emails, and texts to colleagues I know around the country. And we've already had a very nice response, mm-hmm. inquiries, and we fully expect to have a great number of entrants come mid-November.
I should say that we're having this conversation in late September, so it's still a moving target. Do you have a limit to the number of slots available for auditions, or you just expand the hours of your days a little more?
Exactly, the latter, right. We have 3 days scheduled, November 13th through the 15th, that weekend in mid-November, to accommodate a tremendous amount of entrants if we get that many. So.
And the public can attend these.
Yes, that's correct.
And how does that work? So people with an hour to spare can come in and listen to two people play their 25 or 30 minutes? Or
sure.
People can come in for a whole day?
Yes. So we're selling tickets right now for the 3 days of the competition. They're on sale at the Emmons box office mm-hmm. in advance. And then if people want to come and just buy their ticket at the door, they'll be on sale at the Sursa Hall box office where the competition is being held. And we will have the box office managed throughout the day, so you can come at any time and purchase your ticket.
Fantastic. So the I want to go back to how the adjudication works for a minute. So mm-hmm. Will there be a certain number of slots that you the jury, have to limit?
Mm-hmm.
Like, are there X number of slots for the Tokyo auditions, mm-hmm. X number for the London auditions, X number for the Hamburg, X number for Muncie?
That's a great
Again,
question.
Interesting combination of cities. I love that.
Yeah,
I love
that. Being in that company, Sharon, as you can imagine. Wonderful question. I think Frank Vibo, who is going to all the preliminary sites
Good.
And serving on the jury,
yeah.
including at BSU, he would like to have about 48 entrants that advance to Hastings. And obviously with four sites, my math tells me that would be approximately 12 at each site.
Sure.
But I don't think it's that neat and clean. If he hears 18 wonderful pianists at one site, then maybe not as many at the other. But I don't think he's going to limit himself to 48. I think there's a certain standard and expectation there. And if he hears 55... Okay, terrific.
Or if he hears 32.
Or he hears 32,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. What kind of an opportunity, in addition to bringing people to campus who might not normally come to campus, to a fabulous hall, to Sursa Hall,
yes.
What kind of an opportunity is this for the university? What does this help you do in terms of recruiting students or...
Yes. Well, we're all delighted at the university that this bright international spotlight will be shining on our campus. And when I came back from Hastings in March, our dean of the College of Fine Arts, Robert Cavam, encouraged me to go speak with President Ferguson about this possibility of bringing this competition
mm-hmm.
to the campus. And Paul Ferguson, our president, was extremely interested, and he said, "What can I do to help?" And I said, "Well, Paul, we could really use some new pianos." And he said, "Send me a budget." And over $1 million later, we have 14 new Steinways.
Oh, my gosh.
In the School of Music, including a Hamburg Steinway Concert D instrument in Sursa Hall that all the entrants will be performing on. Hamburg Steinway is considered by many to be the finest piano in the world. Steinway is only made in two cities, mm-hmm. Hamburg and New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in Hamburg in June to pick out that gorgeous instrument. Everybody who's played on it this fall is raving about it. And then I was in New York last month to pick out 4 B's for piano faculty studios and 9 O's for practice rooms. So regarding recruiting, that's already a great shot in the arm to have these fantastic new instruments that are servicing not only the concert hall, but piano faculty studios and our grand piano practice rooms. We will have not streaming, but we're going to have a documentary, if you will. We're going to have interviews and with the jury. There will be a 3-member jury with some of the entrants, and that's all going to be accessible on our website, our School of Music website at BSU. We just think having all of these wonderful talented pianists from around North America coming to our campus will just be a real shot in the arm for our current students and also be attractive to potential future students.
Absolutely. The other thing, I believe you're providing a couple of scholarships
yes.
for people to
yes, thank you for reminding me of that.
To
the top two vote getters, if you will, mm-hmm. at the preliminary round, Ball State University is paying their airfare to Hastings, their round trip airfare. And anybody flying into Indianapolis for the competition, we are providing a complimentary shuttle to our campus.
Oh, that's
well.
Fabulous.
So we're doing everything we can to make it as convenient and as accommodating as we can.
The sound you hear in the background is people going, "I think I'm switching my major to music all day."
That would be great.
Sharon Gamble with Ball State University Distinguished Professor of Piano, Bob Palmer, and Assistant to the Director of the School of Music, Rebecca Braun. The auditions are November 13th through the 15th in Sursa Performance Hall on Ball State's campus, and they are open to the public. You can learn lots more by visiting bsu.edu, again, bsu.edu, and then search for Hastings. That is Hastings.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
We've passed the tipping point. The equinox was a few days ago.
It's true.
But nights are getting longer and scarier now that we're into October.
It is fall. And there was that blood moon last weekend.
There was
that
blood
moon,
and the clouds cleared up so we could see it. And we have all sorts of fall-like things to tempt you with on our calendar that we call
What do we do?
What do you got?
Well, you know, I just have to say that I am in love with the false ceiling Indianapolis sculpture out at the IMA in the Ephraimson Family Pavilion, because as a book lover, the whole thing is made out of books, which is so cool. And it was really great that the artist Richard Wentworth was in town and actually used books collected from Indy Reads Books to help make it. But if you haven't seen it, it is just a really great piece and worth checking out, and it's really fun to stand underneath and look at.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, I know, I bet, I'm not a betting person despite my last name, but if I had to bet, I think I have a pretty solid idea where you're going to be Saturday night.
Only one of the most enjoyable, I think, dance events of the year.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Evening with the Stars, the All-Star Indianapolis City Ballet benefit event featuring dancers from American Ballet Theater, Bolshoi Ballet, Berlin Ballet, and more at Clues Memorial Hall. If you have any interest whatsoever in dance and don't have your tickets yet, you better rush and get your tickets.
It's such a great night. And all different types of ballet, classical, contemporary. There's some Broadway pieces, including a piece from On the Town. And it's the first time that's going to be seen, the dream sequence, Pas de Deux, that's not in a Broadway show, but is part of Evening with the Stars. That's going to be a great night.
Indeed. Hey, this weekend marks the return of Cabaret Poe. This time it's going to be performed at Theater on the Square. It's Q Artistry's signature show, spearheaded by Ben Asequi, and it's returning for its sixth local production, this time on Mass Ave at Theater on the Square, opening this Saturday the 3rd and continuing through, well, it's very convenient that Halloween is on a Saturday night this year, so continuing through Halloween. Cabaret Poe.
Very cool. Hey, this isn't really something to go to, but I think it's just a really cool program I want to give a shout out to, because October is National Down Syndrome Awareness Month, and the Kids Dance Outreach, KDO, is launching their newest program, KDO Adaptive Dance, and it's a whole bunch of free dance classes for kids with Down Syndrome, and they are doing it in partnership with Peyton Manning Children's Hospital at St. Vincent, and I think it's just a really neat thing they're doing, so good for them.
Absolutely. Hey, if you were traveling or otherwise engaged and didn't get to see La Casa Azul, Gregory Hancock's opus, last summer, it is a musical and dance event based on the life of Mexican artist Frida Kahlo and her tempestuous relationship with her husband. And it is being reprised at the Tarkington at the Center for the Performing Arts, October 1st through the 3rd. Well, if you're hearing us on Thursday night, you're too late because it was a 7 o'clock performance, but you could still catch tickets for Friday or Saturday. And you can find out more at thecenterfortheperformingarts.org.
Adam's Family.
Uh-oh.
Oh, it's coming to Beef and Boards. Again, another perfect thing for October. The macabre musical comedy is opening on October 8th, running through, actually through November 22nd, so you got some time to go check it out. Directed by Eddie Curry. It should just be a ton of fun. Come for dinner and meet the Adam's Family in this musical.
Thing.
Yes. All of them will be there at Beef and Boards.
But if you know actors in the cast, do not bring them flowers. Bring them the stems of roses. Cut off the flower heads, remember?
Perfect. That's right.
That was Morticia's favorite gift. Hey, first-time effort from the folks at Square Cat Records. It's The Hideaway, a hullabaloo of music and art. This Saturday night, two stages of music will be filled with local, regional, and national acts. And 100 artists are going to show their work at this first-time festival in Fountain Square. Find out more about that by Googling Hideaway Hullabaloo online.
The Bard Fest 2015 is opening this weekend in Carmel. 10 shows in one theater, and some of Indianapolis' best actors are going to be up there. It starts on October 1st. It goes through October 18th. My goodness, there's just pretty much about everything. Everything from As You Like It to Timon of Athens and a whole bunch of other shows that are going to be. Othello is going to be performed.
And nothing to do with the owls.
No.
I was picturing a barred owl.
Oh,
that's a whole other kind of barred fest.
And October 17th, they're having the Shakespeare Mosh Pit with outdoor performances, which that sounds fun too. Outdoor stage in front of the Greek Pizzeria and pizza and beer, craft beer all day as part of it. Anyways, there's a huge long schedule. There's a lot of different productions and lots of different events that are tied to Bard Fest. If you search for First Folio Productions or Bard Fest 2015, you will find it all. It should be a lot of fun opening this weekend in Carmel.
If you've ever worked two jobs to make ends meet, but you didn't want one boss to know about the other job or the other boss, you have the perfect setup to relate to One Man, Two Governors, Richard Bean's play on stage now at the Phoenix Theater. Tickets going fast. It's hilarious. There are elements of farce and crazy 1960s mustaches and wacky costumes and a topsy-turvy story of love triangles and mistaken identities. One Man, Two Governors on stage at the Phoenix Theater right now through October 18th.
Very cool. And just a reminder, Chocolate Fest is coming up on Saturday, October 17th from noon to 4, new location this year at the Dallara IndyCar Factory. It is a fundraiser for Arts for Learning, and there will be 22 different vendors with all their delicious samples, and it sounds like a lot of fun. You can check out more information on the artsforlearningindiana.org website. Sharon!
Oh, are we out of time?
We are out of time.
Oh my gosh, but don't forget, you can always find out more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, and can I hear the scary voice one more time for Nick Major? Happy October from all of us, and we'll see you next week for that calendar we call...
What do we do? Ooh. There we go.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Get your mustard ready. The wieners are coming. That's right. The wiener dog races are back as part of the 7th annual Original and Fabulous German Fest at the Athenaeum. Travis DiNicola spoke with the Athenaeum's president, Cassie Stockamp, to find out more. I'm told no dachshunds were harmed.
Cassie, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always great to have you here.
Love being here. Thank you, Travis.
Of course, because we're here to talk about the 7th fabulous, original, incredible German Fest.
Keep adding those adjectives. It's all good.
It all just keeps coming. It keeps coming. This is such a fun event that the Athenaeum puts on, coming up on Saturday, October 10th, noon to 8, celebrating all things German, including wiener dogs, which we'll get to in just a minute. But before we jump into all that, let's start by just talking about the Athenaeum a little bit, because you, of course, are the president and CEO of the Athenaeum Foundation and oversee that incredible grand old building.
Yeah, that old building. We call her Betty White. She's funny old and everybody loves her. We've had a great year. Lots of fun improvements. New soundboard, light board, new curtains in the theater. So we've done some tuck pointing. Again, not very sexy things, right? Tuck pointing, repair windows, but things that we have to do to maintain that beautiful historic structure because it is truly just a community asset. So
it is.
We've got some
how
big
old
plans.
Is the building?
Oh, how old?
Gosh.
Let's see, 1894.
Wow.
So we're
okay.
121st anniversary.
Yeah,
121st,
yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
But
and it's not easy to keep that old lady looking good.
You know. To be honest, it does. It takes a lot.
Yeah.
It does take a lot. It takes a lot of not only people and companies to help manage the different systems, but it's just financially. It's $250,000 to heat and cool that old building every year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That
alone. A lot of great things going on there. Of course, there's the YMCA and Young Actors Theater and other groups that utilize the building.
It is so much fun, Travis. I jokingly say there's a party every day in the building. Last year, we had over 1,800 events.
Wow.
Over 800,000 people come through the doors. Now, that includes, obviously, the Rathskeller and the Beer Garden,
sure,
and all that happens. But it is part of that whole historic structure. So it is well-used, well-loved. But that also takes a toll on it.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got some plans to do some renovations in the lobby, which I'm really excited about. It needs to be remodeled, but we want to do it in such a way that really makes it appealing and attractive. We're all trying to attract and retain that millennial, right? So
right. We're
going to try to play a role in the play in 2020 to create a space that is a coffee juice bar in that first floor lobby, which is really going to be pretty contemporary and fun. So
when you say the first floor lobby, that's after you come in and go up the stairs.
Correct, where those round settees are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that will become a very... very contemporary space juxtaposed against the old physical building.
Mm-hmm.
So we won't change any of the physical structure, but just the furnishings will be very pop. Let's put it that way.
Excellent.
So, yeah, I'm really, really excited about it.
And there's been a lot of like touring shows that have been performing there as well that you've been bringing in?
Oh, no, we haven't bringing in. We truly are a rental space.
Okay.
My philosophy is I want the community to program the space, and that way it remains reflective and responsive to what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So we have... the Beach Boys sound alike, the
right,
Elvises.
Right.
We've got church on Sunday. We have burlesque coming in next week. We've got, you know,
right.
it's I love it. The free thinkers that founded that building, I think they'd be proud. because they were all about, we need to have that intellectual pursuit of all kinds.
All kinds. All types of stuff.
Exactly. Don't have to like it, but it needs to have a safe place to be. And obviously, being on MassEd, we truly do serve all, and I'm very, very proud of that.
Excellent. Yeah. Yes, you do. Yeah. Yes. So the German Fest, not only is it a lot of fun, but it also does raise some money to help
with
the building, right?
That's our big public way of touching the public, but also it's a fundraiser for us. So we do, all those proceeds go right to helping the building. So we hope people come and pay the entry fee and drink lots of beer.
Sounds good. So, and of course, that's a big part of it, but there's a lot more. Tell me all the things.
Oh, goodness.
Gosh, what's going on this year at the German Fest? Again, Saturday, October 10th.
We start the day with a 5K race. Mm-hmm. People come in their lederhosen, so we hope people will come and race and then stay for a while. We have a strongman competition.
That's always a really cool thing.
It's so interesting, isn't it, to see these people? I'm fascinated just to watch. It's quite a spectacle.
Lifting like thousands of pounds.
Well, it feels like it looks like, but it's like 700-800 pounds. Yeah, I mean, it's almost 1,000 pounds. Yeah. It's a lot. Big, big kids area. This is very, very kids friendly, and they truly are German games that are interactive in a fun bounce house. So there's always literally hundreds and hundreds of kids that are in that space. You know, I'd be remiss in saying we don't have the wiener dog races, right?
Which gets bigger and better every year.
Just have to laugh.
I mean, I know it kind of sort of started almost not quite as a joke, but just like, let's try it. And then all of a sudden all these people showed up and then you had to add grandstands.
Yeah, exactly. We have bleachers.
And it's become a big deal.
It's hilarious.
So who's the favorite this year?
I can't tell. No.
Are there returning champions?
There are returning champions. And so every hour, I think the races start either at 1 or 1:30, and there are three or four. We have champions of the hour.
Okay.
Because those little dogs couldn't hang around. The first year, we were a little naive. We thought the dogs would all stick around and do a runoff at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those little legs can't stick around for four or five hours.
They're very small legs.
They're tiny little guys. So we have races every hour, three or four races on the hour, and it is... It is just comical. It's hilarious.
Well, there are hope. Because, I mean, sometimes you get some dogs that actually really do run.
Yes, yes.
And then you have a fair number of dogs who just kind of sit there or hang out with their buddies.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Or wander in circles.
It's as much fun watching the owners, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just to see
trying to
people,
coax their dog
exactly.
with the little chew toys or whatever it is.
Everybody gets a big kick out of it. And I know there are people already that are training their dogs or getting them out there running those little things.
Oh, goodness.
But two things I have to tell you about. Also, there's... So what were formerly known as the beer games are now the Durstig games, which is the thirsty games. Mm-hmm. And it's not about beer drinking. It is about beer stein holding and beer relay races. And we've got a couple funny things. We're going to actually
you run with a beer without spilling it or
something.
That like
kind
that.
Of exactly yeah. up and over obstacles and just all kinds of silliness. And teams, it's actually become really a team building event for many corporations. So there's a vet that he's right up on Mass Ave that he brings two teams. He says that is their favorite day of the year. Last year they were zombies. They come in a zombie bus.
It's
pretty wild. So that's fun. Two things we're adding this year, though. So on Michigan Street, we keep the street closed down.
Mm-hmm.
Half of it is a Durstig, the beer games. And the other half, we're turning it into a German Autobahn.
Yeah.
We're going to have up to 50 different Porsches parked out front.
That's going to be so cool.
They will be parked. So, and then New Jersey Street, the Indy Urban Flea is going to join us this year. So your entry ticket will also get you into that, and that's just fun. She just pulls together a bunch of really interesting vendors, and we're just trying to continue to shake
so
it
you
up.
You got the How flea market
add?
Going on, you got a Porsche show,
you got a Porsche, yeah, you got the
food. We haven't even talked about food and entertainment yet,
exactly.
Right?
I mean, we've got two stages that are full of everything from yodeling contests to and the beer garden stage this year, in addition to all the German activities going on, we're going to be opening it up to the kids' dance outreach. We're going to have some of the local performers also perform on the beer garden stage because they don't have an opportunity. It's normally just, some high-end bands that are going through there. So it's a big, fun day.
Nice. Lots of bratwurst and
lots of brats and chewy German beer and, and women running around in dirndls. And,
My.
It's all good.
It sounds like just a ton of fun. Where can people get tickets ahead of time, or how does that all work?
Yes, you can buy at the door, $10 at the door, or you can go in advance and get a discount to our website, which is athfound.org.
Mm-hmm.
And kids are $3, pretty good value for what they get.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we hope everybody comes and supports the Athenaeum and just has a great day.
Of course, you don't have to be German.
No. In fact, we don't have to be German. Absolutely not.
Just celebrate. Yeah, I mean, you don't need to be German to celebrate good German food and beer.
Exactly.
And
I celebrate Irish Fest, and I'm right. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Well, it sounds like just a ton of fun. It's always a great event.
Yes.
The fabulous original. Help me with this. What's the full
the
title?
The 7th Original and Fabulous German Fest.
No hyperbole there at all, Cassie. So besides German Fest, what else can we expect going on at the Athenaeum in the coming weeks and months?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So we just are organizing. We're going to do a block party. The Humanities Council, in conjunction with them, on November 20th, all of the tenants in the building, we are going to be doing different activities and events. So that actually will be a fun day, from 4 to 7 p.m. on Friday, November 20th. The building will already be decorated for, I can't believe we're talking about Christmas, but it will already be, and if you've not been in the building at Christmas, it really is spectacular.
It's beautiful.
Rodney does an amazing job. So people can have their Christmas takens in advance before, in front of the Christmas trees. We'll have obviously ethnic food, music, all the different tenants will be doing different things that tie into the whole all-in concept of the Humanities Council. So that's going to be fun.
That sounds like a very good time.
We've not done anything like that before. So there's such a village, literally a village within the village there. So
there really is always something going on there. Now, you're not going to be getting on the roof anytime soon.
I did that once. Thanks. Check
once,
that off
once
my
was
list.
Enough?
Yeah, I did that for a week, right?
Yep. I remember a couple years ago you were up there on the roof raising money to keep the...
It's funny. That's right. It was. It ended on German Fest.
Yeah.
So it's coming right up here. Yeah, yeah. It got a little chilly some of those mornings.
Just a little bit. Mm-hmm. But always a great thing. So again, the Athenaeum German Fest is coming up on October 10th, noon to 8, and lots of other great things going on at the Athenaeum all the time. Lots of great organizations there and events there, always worth checking out. How many events did you say you did last year?
1,800.
My
that's
gosh.
Unbelievable.
So that's,
and now that's
great.
Everything from a 5-person meeting to a 500-person
sure,
event.
But three, four a day sometimes.
Oh.
Or, yeah, who knows?
Or more than that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the building is one of the few buildings it's still being used as it was originally designed.
That's awesome.
And it's a community asset and a community gathering place.
Excellent.
So we're really proud of that.
Meet me at the A. Cassie, thanks so much for coming into Art of the Matter today.
Thanks, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with Cassie Stockham from the Athenaeum Foundation. Discover your inner German at the 7th Annual Original and Fabulous German Fest on October 10th. More information is at athenaeumfoundation.org. Sure, I'll spell that for you. Athenaeum Foundation.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra, from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. I'll meet Encore Vocal Arts' new music director and learn about the first half of their season.
I'll get a preview of Dance Kaleidoscope's newest production.
And I'll chat with the oldest storyteller to win the Emerging Storyteller Award from Storytelling Arts of Indiana, Bob Zalkin. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.